will fatally undermine their party's appeal to voters at the next general election. Former Tory Cabinet Minister David Davis said on Saturday, 2nd of April, that if the Conservatives were to become known as the party of high taxes, the damage to their economic reputation would be as deep and lasting as that inflicted on John Major's government by the disaster of Black Wednesday in September of 1992. David Davis told The Observer that with the country now operating with the highest overall tax burden for decades, the electoral dangers were clear. David Davis added, "Acquiring a reputation for being at the high tax party will do every bit as much damage to the Conservative Party as the ERM crisis did to us in the 1990s. Britain's chaotic and costly exit from the European Union's exchange rate mechanism scarred the Major government's reputation for economic management and put it on course for the crushing defeat by New Labour in 1997. Recently, an opinion poll for the Labour List website caused deep concern among Tory MPs as it found the Conservatives were already seen as the party of high taxation by more voters, about 39%, than had that view of Labour, 27%. Asked which they regarded as the party of low taxation, 30% named Labour and 27% cited the Tories in the Savanta Cumbres survey. Even after offering some limited tax reductions in last month's spring statement, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak tried to ease the effects of the cost of living crisis. The overall burden of taxation in the UK is still at its highest since the 1950s, when the country was rebuilding after the Second World War. Rishi Sunak, who is reportedly heading to California for a holiday over Easter, used his spring statement to cut fuel duty by 5p a litre, and announced that the threshold at which people start paying national insurance would rise from £9,568 to £12,750 in July. However, when insisting he was wedded to low taxes, he decided to hold back most of an estimated £20 billion war chest received from extra tax receipts resulting from inflation for pre-election tax cuts. In a highly unusual move, he promised a reduction in the basic rate of income tax from 20p to 19p, but not until 2024. Many Conservative MPs believe he should bring forward tax cuts now in order to boost growth, and that it will be too late to pose as a tax-cutting chancellor in 2024. Others have criticised Rishi Sunak for failing to do enough to support low earners and those on benefits. On Saturday, 2nd of April, as protests about the cost of living were held across the country, former Conservative leader Ian Duncan Smith said that rather than keeping taxes high to control the deficit, Rishi Sunak should stimulate economic growth by lowering them and at the same time offer more help to people on universal credit by increasing the amount they can earn before their benefits are reduced. Warning against keeping taxes high and the risk of stagflation, low growth plus rising inflation, Ian Duncan Smith said, "Fiscal squeezing is a disaster at this time and we shouldn't do it. Cutting the deficit will actually add to the problem of stagflation." The veteran Conservative MP Peter Bone said the Chancellor had to act now to cut taxes or risk a repeat of the 1990s when voters formed a fixed opinion of a lack of Tory economic competence that proved impossible to shift before the 1997 general election. Veteran Tory MP Peter Bone noted. John Major got the economy back on track after the ERM debacle, but the electorate had made up its mind well before that and thought, we will give the other guys a chance. We have still got time to get this right, but we need to do this now. We need to correct course now. New analysis by the Resolution Foundation of tax measures taken by Rishi Sunak finds that they will raise £14 billion over the course of the financial year. Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Pat McFadden, said the Tories have become the party of high taxation because they're the party of low economic growth. The Tory government is alone among G7 countries in increasing taxes on income this year. The Labour Party is proposing a targeted windfall tax on the profits of North Sea oil and gas companies to help families with their energy bills, and has consistently opposed Rishi Sunak's rise in national insurance contributions. There is also pressure from elsewhere for private companies to offer help. A study of payments to shareholders made by the Big Six energy suppliers shows dividends and share buybacks amounted to £43.5 billion over the past decade. The think tank Commonwealth, which carried out the new research, said the suppliers, Centrica, EDF, E.ON and its subsidiary N-Power, Scottish Power and Scottish and Southern were in a healthy financial position and could afford to offset some of the soaring cost of electricity and gas faced by their customers. Meanwhile, increasing pressure is being felt by food banks as people struggle to make ends meet and resort to increasingly desperate measures to keep warm and feed their families. Gerard Woodhouse, a local Labour councillor who runs the L6 Community Centre in Everton, Liverpool, said the food bank and food union that the charity runs were opening 6 days a week rather than 4 days due to increased demand, but at the same time had seen a reduction in donations in recent days because people who used to donate now need help themselves. He said, shops are donating potatoes, leeks, cabbages, but I can't get rid of them. They're getting handed back to me because people are saying it costs too much to cook. In other cases, he said, people are getting into bed at 6 p.m, so they haven't got to put the heating on or use any electricity. The number of people asking for thicker quilts is crazy. If I had 200 this week, they would have all gone. You hear about the poor times in the 1930s. Those stories are now happening today. It's just going to get worse and worse.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid, and not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan, and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time. But the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit. As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by British royal family for centuries.
When William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness said they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized the slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed the slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution. Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that have used indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value. In that it would show that the Church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the Church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the Church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The Church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the Church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the Church's role in this scandal, but while the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words, top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials,
to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan. What is the main philosophy of fasting in the month of Ramadan? June 14th, 2016. Our responsibility is to work hard to avoid sins and, to put it briefly, to show piety. Piety, which has been considered as the main philosophy and goal of fasting in the month of Ramadan, means this. Piety means taking care of oneself. We should constantly take care of ourselves. Of course, primarily I'm addressing this statement to myself. All of us are responsible. Therefore, we should appreciate the value of the month of Ramadan. We should appreciate the value of this month of Ramadan, which we are in now. Thousands of thousand months of Ramadan have come and gone throughout history, and thousands of thousand months of Ramadan will come and go, during which time we are not living. Amid this billion months of Ramadan in history, we are present in a few of them. In this chain of the months of Ramadan of history, we have been given the opportunity to spend 20, 30, 50, or 60 months of Ramadan from the age of taklif until the end of our lives. So we should appreciate the value of them.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Month of Ramadan draws people's attention to life after death. June 23rd, 2015. One issue that is repeated in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan is drawing people's attention to the worlds after this material world, the world of death, the world of the judgment day, and one's difficulties in facing divine calculations and divine questioning. This is one of the issues that exist in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan. Paying attention to this is very important for us officials who have certain responsibilities. A factor that helps us control and monitor this is attention to these worlds. When we understand that not the weight of an atom becomes absent from him, in Holy Quran, chapter 34, verse 3, that no small move, action, and statement will escape the eyes of divine calculators after our death, and that we will be questioned about all these things. This will deeply affect our behavior, our statements, and our moves.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
New accounts show that former President Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in plans developed by outside advisors to use national security agencies to seek evidence of fraud. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Maggie Haberman, Michael Schmidt, and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Trump Had Role in Weighing Proposals to Seize Voting Machines. Six weeks after Election Day, with his hold on power slipping, President Donald J. Trump directed his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, to make a remarkable call. Donald Trump wanted him to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states, three people familiar with the matter said. Rudy Giuliani did so, calling the department's acting deputy secretary, who said he lacked the authority to audit or impound the voting machines. Donald Trump pressed Rudolph Giuliani to make that inquiry after rejecting a separate effort by his outside advisors to have the Pentagon take control of the machines. And the outreach to the Department of Homeland Security came not long after Donald Trump, in an Oval Office meeting with Attorney General William Barr, raised the possibility of whether the Justice Department could seize the voting machines, a previously undisclosed suggestion that William Barr immediately shot down. The new accounts show that Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in exploring proposals to use his national security agencies to seize voting machines, as he grasped unsuccessfully for evidence of fraud that would help him reverse his defeat in the 2020 presidential election, according to people familiar with the episodes. The existence of proposals to use at least three federal departments to assist Donald Trump's attempt to stay in power has been publicly known. The proposals involving the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security were codified by advisors in the form of draft executive orders. But the new accounts provide fresh insight into how the former president considered and to some degree pushed the plans, which would have taken the United States into uncharted territory by using federal authority to seize control of the voting systems run by states on baseless grounds of widespread voting fraud. The people familiar with the matter were briefed on the events by participants or had first-hand knowledge of them. The accounts about the voting machines emerged after a weekend when Donald Trump declared at a rally in Texas that he might pardon people charged in connection with the storming of the Capitol last 6th of January if he were re-elected. In a statement issued after the rally, Donald Trump also suggested that his vice president, Mike Pence, could have personally overturned the election by refusing to count delegates to the Electoral College who had vowed to cast their votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. The new information helps to flesh out how the draft executive orders to seize voting machines came into existence and points in particular to the key role played by a retired Army colonel named Phil Waldron. According to people familiar with the accounts, Phil Waldron, shortly after the election, began telling associates that he had found irregularities in vote results that he felt were suggestive of fraud. He then came up with the idea of having a federal agency like the military or the Department of Homeland Security confiscate the voting machines to preserve evidence. Phil Waldron first proposed the notion of the Pentagon's involvement to Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, whom he says he served with in the Defense Intelligence Agency. The plans were among an array of options that were placed before Donald Trump in the tumultuous days and weeks that followed the election, developed by an ad hoc group of lawyers like Sidney Powell and other allies including Michael Flynn and Phil Waldron. The group often found itself at odds with Rudy Giuliani and his longtime associate Bernard Kerik, as well as with Donald Trump's White House counsel Pat Cipollone and his team. Around the same time that Donald Trump brought up the possibility of having the Justice Department seize the voting machines, for example, he also tried to persuade state lawmakers in contested states like Michigan and Pennsylvania to use local law enforcement agencies to take control of them, people familiar with the matter have confirmed. The state lawmakers refused to go along with the plan. The meeting with William Barr took place in mid to late November, when Donald Trump raised the idea of whether the Justice Department could be used to seize voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. Donald Trump told William Barr that his lawyers had told him that the department had the power to seize voting machines as evidence of fraud. Donald Trump mentioned a specific state that had used machines built by Dominion Voting Systems, where his lawyers believed there had been fraud, although it is unclear which state Donald Trump was referring to. William Barr, who had been briefed extensively at that point by federal law enforcement officials about how the theories being pushed by Donald Trump's legal team about the Dominion voting machines were unfounded, told Trump that the Justice Department had no basis for seizing the voting machines because there was no probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. It was only after several early options were exhausted that Phil Waldron pitched the idea of using other parts of the federal government to seize the machines to both Rudolph Giuliani and members of the Trump legal team, and also to Michael Flynn and his own associates, including Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne, a wealthy business executive who funded many of the efforts to challenge the election. Phil Waldron, who owns a bar and distillery outside Austin, Texas, was previously best known for having circulated a 38-page PowerPoint presentation to lawmakers and White House aides that that was filled with extreme plans to overturn the election. Rudolph Giuliani was vehemently opposed to the idea of the military taking part in the seizure of voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. The conflict between him and his legal team and Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne came to a dramatic head on 18th of December 2020 during a meeting with Donald Trump in the Oval Office at the White House. At that meeting, Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell presented Donald Trump with a copy of the draft executive order authorizing the military to oversee the seizure of machines. After reading it, Donald Trump summoned Rudolph Giuliani to the Oval Office, according to one person familiar with the matter. When Rudy Giuliani read the draft order, he told Donald Trump that the military could be used only if there was clear-cut evidence of foreign interference in the U.S. presidential election. Sidney Powell, who had spent the past month filing lawsuits claiming that China and other countries had hacked into voting machines, said she had such evidence, the person said. But Rudy Giuliani was adamant that the military should not be mobilized, the person said, and Donald Trump ultimately heeded his advice. Shortly after the Oval Office meeting, Phil Waldron amended the draft executive order, suggesting that if the U.S. Defense Department could not oversee the seizure of machines, then the Department of Homeland Security could, the person said. Around that time, Donald Trump asked Rudy Giuliani to call Kenneth Cusinelli, the acting deputy secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, to ask about the viability of the proposal, according to two people familiar with the matter. Kenneth Cusinelli said that Homeland Security officials could not take part in the plan. All of this was playing out amid open acrimony among White House aides and outside advisers about how best and how far to proceed with efforts to pursue Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud in the election. That same month, during a meeting on another matter, Donald Trump asked Kenneth Cusinelli what he thought of appointing a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Mr. Cusinelli, according to two people briefed on the conversation, said it was not a good idea for a variety of reasons. When Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne arrived at the White House to discuss their plan to use the military to seize voting machines, they were not let into the Oval Office by a typical gatekeeper like Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff. Rather, they were escorted in by Garrett Ziegler, a young aide to another Trump advisor, Peter Navarro, according to Mr. Ziegler's account. I waved in General Flynn and Sidney Powell on the Friday night of the 18th, for which Mark Meadows' office revoked my guest privileges, Mr. Ziegler said on a podcast, adding that he had done so because he was frustrated with the current counsel that Donald Trump was getting. Even Rudy Giuliani, who had spent weeks peddling some of the most outrageous claims about election fraud, felt that the idea of bringing in the military was beyond the pale. After Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell left the Oval Office, according to a person familiar with the matter, Rudy Giuliani predicted that the plans they were proposing were going to get Donald Trump impeached.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of five Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamashi from Yabet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the two youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there, so their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics, because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
An Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived in Syria, headed by Deputy Parliament Speaker Ali Nikzad. He met with Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoudeh Sabbagh, hailing the distinguished relations between the Syrian and Iranian parliaments. Sabbagh expressed appreciation to Iran's steadfast and principled stances in support of Syria, especially in its